Today we're going to be looking at the book of Ecclesiastes, and the heart of the question of the book is, what profit has a man? And I think, just to get you turned around here, they put page 197 as the first page, but your handout, it should be 196. So the book of Ecclesiastes has 12 chapters, and just for a moment I'll reflect with you on what the title means. Basically, it's the Greek word for assembly, ekklesia. We often have referred to the church as the ekklesia, or the gathering, the assembly. It comes from actually the Greek translation of the Hebrew version of the book of Ecclesiastes. The key word, or the author of the book, is named the preacher, or the Koheleth. And the Koheleth is the one who calls together the assembly. And so when the Greeks interpreted that word, they called it the Ecclesia, or the book of Ecclesiastes. But it properly probably should be called the book of the preacher, or the book of the assembly of the preacher. Now, we don't know who the preacher is definitively from the book itself, but the traditional view has been that this is King Solomon. And the reason why is because you see from the text that the person is a king over all of Israel, that he is a son of David, that he describes himself as one who has surpassed all others in wisdom. And you start to read some of the things that he describes in his life about the amassing of great wealth and the amassing of many slaves and many wives and this sort of thing. And it starts to all kind of appear to be King Solomon. And so people have traditionally held that King Solomon is the author of the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, modern scholars debate that and question whether Solomon is the one. And the reason why they do that is often because of the not only things within the text that say that he follows after many kings, but also because the linguistic nature of the book of the Hebrew of the book of Ecclesiastes seems like it's a later that dates more to the 5th century than the 10th century of the nation of Israel. The book itself actually doesn't, again, make that big of a deal out of who this actually is. It claims as its authority not the name of Solomon, but actually at the end of the book in chapter 12, verse 11, says that these are the collected sayings of wisdom from the one shepherd. And who's the one shepherd? The Lord. So the basis of the authority of Ecclesiastes from the preacher's own words are that it comes from the Lord. The major theme of the book centers around the word in Hebrew, which is hebel, which can be translated vanity. It's often translated vanity or meaninglessness. It literally should probably be translated vapor. And using a play on words, he says, a chasing after the wind. And so it might be more appropriately translated as vapor. Vapor, vapor, all is vapor. We might say in our modern parlance, vacuous. It's nothingness. It's nothing there. It's vacuous. But the preacher is reflecting essentially on the significance and meaning of life. And over again, he says, it appears that life really has no meaning, that it appears to be just a vapor, that everything is a vapor, all is a vapor. And he actually argues for that in his book, that there is no significance in this world in and of itself, apart from God, that is. When you pursue significance and meaning apart from fear of the Lord, meaningless, vapor, that's all it is. When you bring the sovereignty of God into life and into the things of your work and your everyday going in and out, well, then it has value and significance. But that only happens when you come underneath the fear of the Lord. Pursue the world and life and significance and meaning from a selfish standpoint, and it's all meaningless. That's the heart of the book, a grasping at a vapor, a chasing after the wind. It is somewhat structured as a book, though I can tell you from reading the book of Ecclesiastes, I wish I had had about 2 or 3 months to prepare for this rather than a week. The book of Ecclesiastes is a very, very deep book. It gets into some very deep philosophical questions, and I would say that one could spend a lifetime meditating on the Proverbs and the things that are within this book, and you could spend time just thinking and meditating on each little passage. But if you take a step back and you look at the big picture, essentially the book divides into two places, and you see, just as in the book of Job, there's a transitional poem in the middle of the book. And the transitional poem has to do with moving from despair to wisdom. And that really tells you what the movement of the book itself is, or the argument of the preacher is. In the first half of the book, what he's trying to get across is that humanity pursuing selfishly its own ambitions, that just leads to meaninglessness. That's just vanity. And where that should lead you if you pursue that route is into despair of self. That you should lament and despair of even your very life, because there is no significance apart from God. But there is a wisdom that comes from outside of ourselves. And when we get to that place of lamenting and becoming completely and totally disillusioned with self, then we might attain to where true wisdom comes from, fear of the Lord. And so the second half of the book, he is really speaking more about the fear of the Lord. He builds on the themes of the first half, but he's emphasizing the conclusion of the matter, which he will ultimately get to at the very end, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So it essentially has a two-part structure, man's futility and searching after God in a selfish, ambitious way, and then the true path to wisdom is the fear of God and the work of God. That's the second half of the book, beginning with chapter 7, verse 15. There is a prologue and an epilogue. Again, just like the book of Job has that prologue and epilogue, the prologue really sets the stage for the question that he's asking, what does it profit a man? And then at the end, he returns back to himself and says that ultimately wisdom really is not found in me, but in God and the one shepherd. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So he answers his question at the end in the epilogue that he asks in the beginning. So the prologue, what profit has a man? Take a look with me at chapter 1, verse 1 through 11. Many people see this as the thesis statement of the book of Ecclesiastes, including me. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? That's the key question that he's asking. And he is going to say, ultimately, nothing. That if that's the measure by which you're going to measure things, what you can do with yourself, it's all meaningless and purposeless. In other words, that's not the significance of humanity and selfish pursuit and selfish profit. The significance is going to come from something else. But if that's the question, then the answer is vanity. He actually tells us his argument right there at the beginning of the book. And he goes in this first 11 verses in what are sometimes called the vanity cycles. The cycles of meaninglessness. And he describes several of them. Chapter 1, verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. That's the vanity of the cycle of the generations. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises again. Just around and around the sun goes. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north and back around again. The cycle of the weather. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea's not full. It goes back to a place where the streams flow from again. The cycle of water just seems to keep going and going and going, around and around and around. Does life ever feel like a merry-go-round to you? Does it seem to be the same old, every single day, just seeming to go around in a circle, like the little circle that the mouse runs on, the wheel? Every day the mouse wakes up and he hops on the wheel. Is that what life is to you, just running the wheel? That's what the writer of Ecclesiastes is trying to get you to think like. You know, is life just cyclical, going around in a circular pattern? No meaning, no point, just round and round we go. What has been is, and what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? No, it's already been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. In a lot of ways, sometimes people have accused the preacher of being a bit of a pessimist, that, you know, just around and around we go. We mentioned Eeyore earlier. It's probably going to rain again today. Sun goes up, sun goes down. It's probably going to come back around again. Just around the circle we go. And he's trying to get you to feel that way. In a lot of ways, the preacher is an existentialist philosopher. He wants you to feel the angst or the anxiety of life. And so the next three chapters, chapters 1, verse 12 through chapter 3, verse 22, he's exploring man's futile search for meaning under the sun. And the preacher observes that there is marked futility in the human condition. It seems to him that the more he considers the purpose for human labor and toil and existence, the more complicated and vexing that question becomes. He's looking for wisdom, but as he applies his mind and his heart to the study of wisdom, he begins to perceive that that effort itself is what he describes a striving after the wind. In other words, the more he pushes in on this question, the more futile and futile it seems. Verse 17, "And I applied it my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation." The more you know, the more you realize you don't know. The wiser you get, the dumber you get. And so as he got deeper and deeper into the question of pursuing wisdom, he got more and more confused about knowledge. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So he begins to use and reflect on his own life experience as the test case and example of why life is meaningless. First, he does what a lot of people do. He begins to try to find significance and meaning in the undisciplined pursuit of more. He wants to acquire a lot of things. And he says, if my eye looked at it, I didn't deny it of myself. If I wanted it, I bought it. And so I just started acquiring things. I didn't deny myself any pleasure that I wanted. If he was living in today's, I get my two-car garage, I got my sports car, I got my beautiful wife, I got these great kids. The way he describes it is, with concubines and wonderful parks and fountains and all the kinds of things, houses, gardens. He's just not denied himself anything. And yet, house on the golf course, on the lake, whatever it is your dream is, you know, if I could only acquire this, then I'll be happy. This pleasure, this fulfilling thing in life, or better vacations, whatever it is. And yet he discovers that after he's acquired all of these things, emptiness, vanity, nothing. I think many people have realized that the pursuit of more ultimately is a vain exercise. So then he says, I'll try to become wise. And he went from the satisfying the physical pleasures of his flesh to trying to satisfy the inquiries of his mind. And he realized that that actually didn't really satisfy and bring any profit. He went to, maybe it's in my work. If I'll invest myself in my work, then I'll find significance and meaning. But then he realized the meaninglessness of that, and that his toil and labor didn't have any purpose or significance that it would bring to him. There was no profit in it. And so he reflects on all of this driving after the wind brings him to a little poem reflecting on the timing of God. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted. It's a very famous poem in the book of Ecclesiastes. And what he's reflecting on is really a preview of the answer that he's going to give. God has made everything good and ordered things according to its time. And it's only in finding our significance in the providential and sovereign hand of God that any of this makes any sense at all. It's only when we order ourselves in accordance with His good purposes. The problem is, He has His good purposes, but we don't know what they are. And so we try to create meaning and significance in things other than His mysterious will. But God has ordered things according to His time and His sovereign will. He's made everything beautiful, verse 11 of chapter 3, in its time. And He's also put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. In other words, what's driving us in this quest for meaning and significance is our eternal nature. God has put eternity in our hearts, and yet has not given us the full picture of what eternity is all about. And that becomes the crux in our quest for significance and meaning. And what it should drive us to, and this is what he's arguing, is to seek after the one who is the author of eternity, God. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat, drink, and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. When we go back, or when we look at things from that ultimate and eternal perspective, then we just go through life and enjoy it. Pursue life and we lose our enjoyment of it. Pursue God and we enjoy life. It's a bit paradoxical, isn't it? And this is why the book of Ecclesiastes makes your head strain as you're reading it. It's filled with paradoxes. You know, on the one hand, he's saying, enjoy life, enjoy what you've been given. And then on the other hand, he says, all in life is meaningless. Well, which is it, preacher? Do we enjoy it? Or is it meaningless? Yes. It's meaningless in and of itself. It becomes filled with enjoyable significance when you find it as being temporary things, giving their timing and significance in the providential sovereign will of God. But outside of that, it's meaningless. It's the paradox of the book. And so he continues to explore this idea of selfish ambition, man's futile search for more and more things. So the preacher turns to this reflection in chapter 4, through chapter 6, verse 12, to a reflection on human beings' selfish ambition and how futile that is. This pursuit has led to bitter tyrannies and oppression. It is self-consuming. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. If you're a victim of oppression, you know, you take a look at that, it seems like those who are dead are more or luckier, basically, than the ones that are alive. They're more fortunate. But better than both is he who has not been and not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Better to not even be born if you're going to be born into this oppressive and fallen and tyrannical world. And I saw the toil and all the skill and work that come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This is vanity, striving after the wind. You know, he's looking at the, you know, it's our covetousness that is driving us to this ambition for more and more and more. And ultimately what that leads to is consuming ourselves. Notice what he goes on to say. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Graphic images of the end of selfish ambition and the futility of it. So he goes on for a while reflecting on selfish ambition. Chapter 4, verse 7 and 8. Again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, yet son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of all this pleasure?" This also is vanity and an unhappy business. What's he saying there with that? Ultimately, when you're self-absorbed and selfish ambition, it becomes a very lonely, lonely exercise. And you just keep pursuing, not realizing that you're only doing it for yourself. And you never ask yourself, why am I working so hard for all this stuff when there's nobody in my life to enjoy it? You know, I look at so many of the people that in our culture, and I struggle with it. I mean, we all struggle with this. We work so hard to the exclusion of our marriages, our relationships with our children. And what he's asking is, what's the point of that? Why are we doing that? Because at the end of the day, if you've gained the whole world, but you've lost your family, your children, of what value is that? You don't have anybody to share all the money you made or the great accomplishments that you've accomplished. So ultimately, the selfish pursuit of more and more wealth will prove to be unsatisfying. It leads to stress, more worries because there's more to lose. At the end of the day, it's all going to be lost anyway. And this is where we get that verse, as he came from his mother's womb, so shall he go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil, and that he may carry away in his hand. We summarize that as, you can't take it with you. We often say that, you can't take it with you. So the conclusion is, hold all of this stuff loosely. If you have wealth, well, enjoy it, but recognize it could be taken away from you like that. Many people who went through the stock market crash of 2008 understand this all too well, where you've built up this big portfolio of stocks and bonds and set up your retirement, only to lose half of it in a day. Or an incredible business, and then the business all dries up. What was all that work for? He says, it seems futile. What should we think of that? How should we make an understanding of that when that happens? Well, we recognize that we enjoy it while we have it. And when we don't have it, we recognize that that too is from the hand of God. The end of selfish ambition for the earthly and temporal minded is ultimately despair, because the future is always unpredictable. Ecclesiastes 6:12, who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? It's that uncertainty of the future that ultimately means that our pursuits are ultimately meaningless. So we have to hold them loosely. And so this leads us to that question of despair. Do you have a thing with chapter 7 on it? 199. Is that in your handout? Okay. So this is the hinge poem in the book of Ecclesiastes, right in the middle of it. And it really is the transition point. If you look with me at Ecclesiastes chapter 7, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. In other words, despair is actually the path to gladness. And you need to go to this place of despairing. What do we need to despair of? We need to despair of the things that we're trying to find our significance in, selfish ambition. And then out of that despair, and in a sense, out of death to self, not unlike what Jesus taught. If you want to find life, you got to die to self. Pick up your cross, follow me. Whoever loses their life will gain it. Whoever gains their life in me will, or whoever loses their life in me will find it and gain their life. And so the writer of Ecclesiastes is giving us that crucified life right here in chapter 7. It's in death that we actually find life, and it's in death that we find wisdom. Look at verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. So verse 13, consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? It's the Lord's work, ultimately, not our own, that we need to find our wisdom in. And this is the heart of what this poem is trying to hinge us to despair of selfish ambition and look for wisdom in the work of God and what God finds important. This is the true path of wisdom, the fear of God. So chapter 7, 15 to 9, 10 is reflecting on the key to wisdom found in trust and fear of the sovereign God. Again, there's a lot of meaninglessness even in this section. There's a lot of references to things that don't make sense or that are insignificant. But he continually brings us back to the fear of the Lord. Man needs to be humble in our self-estimation. Man is hopelessly inadequate in our own depravity. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 20. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. We are our own worst barrier to discerning wisdom in our sin. And so it's in that humble estimation of self that we have to turn towards God. God is the one who makes man upright. Yet, verse 7, verse 29, God is the one who makes man upright, yet men have sought out many schemes. The Lord is the one who gives us significance and righteousness. But we keep trying to come up with better ideas than that. So fear of God is man's only hope. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 8, 12 through 13. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he does not fear before God. So the author, the preacher, challenges his reader that, again, the fear of the Lord is the source and beginning of wisdom. Now, when you get to chapter 9, verse 12, it's almost an application section is probably the best way to think about it. He's giving a lot of different proverbs, and I don't have time in the next 5 minutes to summarize all of it or to go into detail with all of it, but essentially a way to look at this section is the preacher is cautioning his reader to live in the wisdom of the fear of the Lord amidst the uncertainty of this life. And amidst the fallen nature of this life, recognizing that, again, hold loosely the things of this world. Enjoy them while you have them. There's nothing wrong with enjoying the things of this world. He says to do that. You know, eat, drink, be merry. That comes from Ecclesiastes. He's not saying, you know, you need to live like a hermit and not enjoy any of the finer things or enjoy wealth, but just recognize that there's no significance in these things. And if you have some blessings, count your blessings before the Lord. And if you don't have blessings, well, recognize that that comes from the hand of God as well. That all of these things are to be stewarded, both our prosperities and our adversities. And the Lord calls us to trust Him with our hearts and with our lives in order to experience the blessing of His life. Wisdom has advantage, but it's often dismissed by those who are fools. and it will therefore be forfeited by those who give their life to folly. And so life is filled with adversity, but our call is to steward the wisdom of God, which is found in the work of God. And he writes at the end of the book to the young, who so often do fall for the folly. If you look at chapter 12, verse 1, he says, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth." And he wants the young people to, in a sense, begin their lives with the end in mind. Because as you're embarking on this life, and you're about to engage in all these things that this world has to offer, for good and for bad, ultimately remember that the Lord was the one who gave you your life, and ultimately he's going to be the one that's going to take your life. And you're going to end up becoming dust again, and your spirit's going to return to him. And so start life with the Lord so that you'll finish with him. Again, the conclusion of the matter at the very end: "Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or for evil."